My name is Einat Wilf, and this is the We Should All Be Zionists podcast. Each week, I'll be reading one essay from my latest collection of essays book, We Should All Be Zionists, on issues facing the Jewish people and Israelis today: conflict, peace, religion, politics, past, present, and future. At the end, I'll be joined by columnist Blake Flayton for a discussion on the themes of the essay and how they apply to contemporary Israel and Jewish life. You can purchase your own copy of We Should All Be Zionists anywhere you get your books. Thanks for listening. Let's start. Democracy Against All Odds, essay co-authored with Shani Moore for Horizons. The intense debate that was the Zionist Congress became the Parliament of the State of Israel, the Knesset. But the Knesset had a unique mark, which the Zionist Congress did not possess, being a voluntary association. It brought into the debate two groups that became part of the State of Israel very much involuntarily: Arabs and Haredi Jews. Arab citizens of the State of Israel were understandably less than excited that they had lost the war against partition and had become citizens of a state they never wanted. Haredi Jews viewed the entire Zionist enterprise as a rebellion against God and Messiah, as indeed it was, and were at best deeply ambivalent that it was the godless communists of early Zionism who had brought about the establishment of the third sovereign state of the Jewish people. In fact, had it not been for the Holocaust, the vast majority of them would not have immigrated to the newly established state for the purpose of rebuilding their world of Eastern European yeshivas, which had been annihilated by Nazi Germany. Having spent more than 50 years fiercely debating the Zionist project, it was logical, if not very natural, to extend the debate to those groups who became citizens of the State of Israel, regardless of their views. From its onset, the State of Israel became a fierce debate over what it means to be the Jewish state, with the debate conducted now not only among Zionist Jews, but expanded to include the views of anti-Zionist Arabs and anti-Zionist Haredi Jews. The elected parliament of the State of Israel became a place where those who argued against the very existence of the State of Israel, or at the very least made it clear that they could very well do without it, were represented, something which does not exist in any other parliament in the world. Democracy as necessity. What makes Israel a democracy is necessity. Israel is a democracy not because it has a beautifully written constitution that guarantees democracy. It doesn't. Israel is a democracy not because its founding parents read John Locke or John Stuart Mill. They may have, but they also read Karl Marx and Leon Trotsky. Israel is a democracy because democracy was the only available mechanism to mediate and settle the fierce debates about what it meant to be the Jewish state. Perhaps the notion that Israel became a democracy out of necessity sounds less inspiring, as if somehow such a democracy is less noble and less worthy. But over time, just as having no choice in war has meant that Israel had to win, having no choice but to be a democracy has meant that over time, Israel has become one of the world's most successful and effective democracies. 70 years after declaring independence, Israel is the world's 10th oldest continuous democracy. It had universal suffrage from its first day, yes, Arab citizens too, and has continued to operate without military coups, civil wars, emergency governments, suspensions of basic political or civil liberties, no opposition leaders in jail, or canceling of elections to this day, surviving even the assassination of a prime minister. Israel was not the only newly independent state to emerge in the aftermath of World War II and to begin its days as a democracy. But it has been the only one to never fall, even temporarily, into some kind of authoritarianism. Even compared to more established and wealthier democracies, Israel can be proud of the stability and longevity of its democracy. Its first parliament sat in 1949 and was empowered by an electorate of all its adult citizens counted equally. The first Belgian parliament to count women's votes equally was only convened later that same year. The first British parliament to be elected without the practice of plural voting was elected the following year, in 1950. The final restrictions on women's voting in Switzerland were revoked only in 1990. The vote was only guaranteed for African Americans in the United States in 1965. Restrictions on the voting rights of Aboriginals in Australia were lifted in 1962. Restrictions on the voting rights of First Peoples in Canada were definitively lifted in 1960. Israel is one of only 20 or so countries out of 200 that has been rated free by Freedom House in each of its annual reports since the organization started keeping track of democracy around the world nearly half a century ago. Of the very few countries that have been practicing democracy uninterrupted longer than Israel, most have only done so for slightly longer than Israel, Denmark, Netherlands, Norway, Sweden, and none have done so in conditions of ongoing conflict, repeated wars on multiple fronts, terrorism, waves of immigration in unparalleled proportions, and a population of vast linguistic, national, religious, and ethnic diversity. It is precisely this stunning achievement, under such difficult conditions, that makes Israel's quite imperfect, necessarily imperfect, democracy such a fascinating topic of study. In fact, anyone interested in democracy per se should be very interested in studying Israel, even if they have no interest in the specific Israeli story, Judaism, Zionism, or the conflict. So, Israel is very much a democracy. But that does not mean that everyone who participates in the democratic system is a democrat. In fact, many have decidedly undemocratic and certainly illiberal visions for the state and society. But since none of the non-democratic and illiberal forces within Israel are capable of imposing their will, as loud as they may be, Israel's democracy remains vibrant. This is why the system should not be changed. In Israel, the greater the debate, the stronger the democracy. As much as Israelis might crave consensus, it is in periods of greater consensus that Israeli democracy has been weakened, and in periods of great strife that Israeli democracy has shown itself to be vibrant. This is the paradox of Israeli democracy. It is more democratic, more open, more inclusive, and more liberal than at any point in its history. But there is greater voice and representation for illiberal, religious, and supremacist worldviews that were once suppressed in the debate. Democracy and the territories. All of this is true for the sovereign state of Israel within what is known as the pre-1967 lines, or more accurately, as the 1949 armistice lines. Those are the lines that separate the state of Israel from the territories acquired in the 1967 Six-Day War. Initially, all of these territories, tripling Israel's pre-1967 size, came under military occupation. There is a common mistake and misperception that occupation of territory is illegal. One is often likely to hear that the Israeli occupation is illegal. Military occupation of territory acquired in war is actually legal, sanctioned by international law in both the Hague Convention of 1907 and the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949. Both these documents specify the responsibility of occupying powers, but the occupation itself is legal. The underlying assumption of the legality of occupations, and the reason that, as such, They do not challenge the democratic nature of the occupying power, such that it is that they are temporary. That is, the occupying power holds onto the territory until conditions enable the attainment of peace or an end to hostility. For example, the American occupation of parts of Germany ended officially in 1990, and no one has ever challenged America's democracy on those grounds. Ever since 1967, Israel has indeed demonstrated that it views the occupation of the various post-1967 territories as temporary, and when it did have claims on the territory, it annexed in a way commensurate with its democracy, as demonstrated in the following instances. 1. The Sinai Peninsula was handed over to Egypt as part of the 1979 peace agreement. 2. The sparsely populated Golan Heights has been annexed to Israel, with all residents wishing to do so becoming citizens of the State of Israel. With regard to the few who have chosen not to attain citizenship, the reason comes down to the fear that should the Golan Heights be handed over to Syria, the fact that they have assumed Israeli citizenship will be viewed as a dangerous form of collaboration with the enemy. The possibility of trading the Golan Heights for peace with Syria has been repeatedly pursued by successive Israeli governments, but with the situation in Syria as it is highly likely that the Golan Heights will remain part of Israel and its democracy for the foreseeable future. 3. The Gaza Strip, under Egyptian military occupation until 1967, was under Israeli occupation between 1967 and 1994, when 80% of the strip was handed over to Palestinian control as part of an international agreement. In 2005, Israel disengaged from the remainder of the territory and made a full military and civilian retreat from every square kilometer of the area. Israel makes no territorial claims on Gaza, and despite ongoing military hostilities, Gaza is not part of Israel. Israel is a democracy in an ongoing state of war with Gaza, but the war itself does not challenge Israel's status as a democracy beyond the line that separates Gaza from Israel. 4. Within the West Bank, Israel has annexed some of the territory to form the greater city of Jerusalem. The residents in the annexed territories have the option of becoming citizens of Israel democracy, an option that the vast majority have rejected, with the view that it is a form of collaboration with the enemy. 5. The remaining territory of the West Bank was not annexed to Israel. While Israel does argue that it has legitimate claims to at least part of the territory, and while there are those in Israel who demand that Israel annex large parts of it, the State of Israel has not annexed the West Bank. Moreover, Israel has, under successive governments, signaled its willingness to end the military occupation in a peace agreement with the Palestinians. This led to the Oslo Accords of 1993, which today governs the lives of the vast majority of Palestinians as a form of basic self-governance. Getting to finality. In one form or another, Israel has divested itself from most of the territories it acquired by way of its stunning victory over three Arab armies in the Six-Day War. Israel has repeatedly demonstrated that it views the occupation of those territories as temporary and has acted in accordance with that assumption. When it did not, it annexed certain territories and brought their citizens into Israel's democracy. As a result, the status of most of the territories has been settled in a way that does not challenge Israeli democracy. And as a result, Israel is in a gradual process of settling its final borders, as more and more of its Arab enemies are coming to terms with its existence. The last remaining debate rages over Israel's eastern border and the status of the West Bank. The reason this debate still rages is that despite bold attempts by Israel in 2000 and 2008 to end the occupation of the West Bank in a full peace agreement with the Palestinians that would have settled all claims, a Palestinian yes has not been forthcoming. As a result, there are illiberal, messianic, and supremacist voices represented in Israel's parliament that propose a vision of Israeli permanent control over the territory and one that would deny its Palestinian residents full rights. Should they succeed, which contrary to the sharp debate, they are a long way from achieving, it would indeed mean that Israel is no longer a full democracy of all its citizens. The Israeli parliament is the most diverse workplace in Israel. Every one of the 120 members of the Knesset must contend daily with acknowledging that those whom he or she believes are leading the country on the road to hell have an equal vote and an equal say in shaping the future of the country. Israel's democracy forces us all to realize that the right of all participants to shape the future is equal to one's own, even though what we would really like is for them to disappear. Israel can boast of numerous achievements, but perhaps none compares to sustaining 70 years of fierce debate. And as we look to the future, the fact that each of us has the feeling that there are still not enough of me and way too much of them means that we can all agree on one thing. Given how each one of us fears that the others might take over, it is far better for the debate to continue than for it to be settled.
That is a wonderful essay. In fact, it's one of my favorite essays, and I believe that I read it for the first time before the current balagan started in the state of Israel. So now, obviously, there are several more insights and several more things that we can learn about it. I guess I'll start with a question that you've been asked many times at this point in interviews and on podcasts and et cetera. The word on everyone's lips these days in July of 2023 is demokratia, the protest movement in Israel, which tells the public that it's standing for democracy, for liberalism in Israel, for checks and balances between branches of government, are entering their 29th week of demonstrations. And, you know, it's quite intense, having been in many of these hafganot, or demonstrations, as it's known in Hebrew. The emotions are very high. There's this feeling of, you know, imminent destruction of the country. The speeches are very dramatic, and people are getting arrested, and there's water cannons, and it's a very intense scene. So my question is, and again, you've been asked this many times before, judicial reform, or depending on which newspaper you read it, judicial overhaul, judicial revolution, judicial coup, does this pose a threat to Israel's democratic structure? Let's say if the government gets everything it wants, so the reasonableness standard of the Supreme Court goes out the window, and maybe there's a Knesset override of, you know, maybe 62, 63, 64 seats. What kind of threat does this pose to Israel's system of democracy?
So the thing that really stands from this essay that I think holds up very well is the notion of Israel as a democracy of necessity. The notion that we are a democracy not because we have these noble ideals, not because we have any checks and balances, not because we have a constitution, which we clearly don't, that our democracy rests on something very different. And it first and foremost rests on the fact that we're just stuck together. And that's what Shani and I meant by democracy of necessity, that very few people in Israel's democracy are actually Democrats by their inclinations, in the sense that they are just these neutral Democrats of rules-based order, that whatever the rules yield, they're fine. If this government or that government, it's fine. Very few people who participate in Israel's democracy have actual democratic instincts. And our democracy is really just the outcome of all of us being stuck together and having these fiercely competing visions about what Israel should be. And since none of us are able to impose our vision on anyone else, democracy has only become the mechanism by which we argue with each other. So I think that part holds up very well. And I don't think that Israel's democracy depends on this or that institutional arrangement. At the end of the day, whatever the specific institutional arrangement, I will say it does matter that Israel is a parliamentary democracy, contrary to those who are enamored with the American system and think that the West Wing is American democracy. Presidential systems tend more often to descend to authoritarian regimes. Parliamentary systems are the systems that have sustained the most successful democracies over time. So I do think that Israel, it matters that Israel is a parliamentary democracy. If anything, and Shani and I are working on it now, if anything, our comment is that the problem is not between the executive and the judiciary in Israel. The problem is that both the courts and the government have taken power away from parliament. And both of them need to give it back to parliament, not to each other. That's not where the problem is. Once you understand that parliament is where the power should reside, in parliament, we're stuck together. In parliament, I remember that from my days in the Knesset. Seriously, I would look at people around me in the Knesset. I was like, I can't believe that, you know, they have the same vote as I do, that they get to make the same decisions as I do. And that's actually the most noble ideal of democracy, that you're sitting stuck with people whose views you detest, and you accept their equal power to determine the future of this country as much as you do. So I think the path forward is much more about bringing the power back to parliament. And it's not about this back and forth between the courts and the government.
Interesting, interesting. Another question I had was, growing up, my Jewish community was almost defined by arguing. I like to say that I got my start in my political career at the Shabbat dinner table growing up, because my parents would always like to play devil's advocate to rile my sister and I up about this or that topic. And, you know, my synagogue constantly held these debates, whether it was on the Iran deal or whether it was on Women of the Wall. And I went at a very young age, and that was the world that I grew up in. And, you know, at summer camp, we would have discussions about the complexities facing Israel, which is why I find the whole "I was lied to at summer camp" narrative to be ridiculous, because you weren't going to a good enough summer camp, yeah, or Jewish enough summer camp. But then as I got to college and I, you know, started to experience very virulent anti-Israel activism, I found myself in a crowd of Jews who were against BDS and who were against anti-Zionism. And the thing that they stressed above all else was Jewish unity. We have to be unified. And, you know, we have to think together, we have to act together, and we can't, you know, have complex discussions about Israel, because Israel's our homeland and that's it. And then I got here and I heard some of those same messages, usually from the right, yeah, that were Am Yisrael, you know, living in Eretz Yisrael, and we, you know, we all have to pretend that everything's okay, and bickering only helps the enemy. What would you say about that? And is there something inherently Jewish in not conforming to that prescription?
Oh, certainly. I would even argue that Jewish unity is not a thing.
Me too.
Like, it's actually not a thing.
It's never been a thing.
No, it's never been. I mean, one of the things that, and we talk about it in this essay, that the achievement of Israeli democracy is remarkable, and especially when you add into the pot the wars, the terrorism, the waves of immigration on a scale that's unparalleled. And you think, actually, that none, almost none of Israel's citizens came from democratic traditions in their host countries, Arab or Jew. So Arab citizens in Israel did not come from democratic traditions. Jewish citizens who came from Arab countries did not come from democratic traditions. Russia, Poland, those are not democratic traditions, certainly at the time when Jews came. So you're thinking about all the citizens of a state essentially not bringing democratic traditions with them. You know, you can talk about the American colonies having some kind of British tradition or something. There's no such thing here. So the tradition that sustains Israeli democracy is the Jewish tradition of argumentation that goes back to Abraham arguing with God, Moses arguing with God, the Talmud as a codification of argumentation. I mean, it says a lot that our central kind of religious texts codify arguments rather than exactly what to do. It says a lot that we don't have people who are responsible for doctrine, what to think. So Jewish unity is really not a thing. I can assure you there's a lot of Jews in the world today who say a lot of things that drive me up the wall. And I'm like, damn, we are our own worst enemies. At one point, when it all came to the BDS issue and stuff, I remember thinking it's actually an intra-Jewish debate.
Absolutely.
The Palestinians are really not in that debate.
The biggest mouthpieces for BDS on campus are always the Jews. And I used to, you know, think more of along the lines of, well, you know, these are Jews who've been led to believe terrible things about the state of Israel and their own identities have been weaponized against them. And therefore they're weaponizing against other Jews. But now I realize that a lot of this boils down to just Jews having grievances against other Jews and it like being an obstacle to how we want to express ourselves. It's very intercommunal.
Completely. So, and that really is, when I look at that and really it drives me up the wall and I'm like, damn, why are they Jewish? And, you know, how can they be speaking in the name of being Jewish? But then I remind myself, like, I breathe, I'm like, and then I'm like, that's how it's always been. And that's one of the benefits sometimes of looking historically. We think about this moment in Israel as a moment of great disunity, great argumentation. But a lot of what I teach is about early Jewish debates in the late 19th century, early 20th century. That was really a moment of massive Jewish debates. I mean, you had Jews arguing for assimilation and Jews arguing for building up the walls. And you had Jews who were leaders of communism and Zionists, of course. So that was a real moment of massive Jewish argumentation. This moment pales in comparison.
Good to hear.
Good to hear.
So shifting gears a little bit. So we've established that the democratic tradition is a necessity in Israel by way of Jews having vastly different interpretations of what a Jewish state should be. And we've talked about how as long as Israel really remains Jewish and that tug of war exists, it will remain a democracy regardless of which institution, you know, has more power in the bickering over checks and balances. This morning, but at the end of your essay, you get into the territories that were conquered after 67. And you talk about how Israel has always put itself in a position to trade land for peace if it means safety and security for its people and it means the continued democratic experiment within Israel.
Yep.
However, this morning, Thomas Friedman wrote an article in the New York Times, and one sentence really caught my eye because it doesn't really pose a red flag to maybe the average New York Times reader, but to someone who's invested in Israeli geopolitics, it certainly is a giveaway as to what he's really thinking. He calls the idea that the West Bank is still a bargaining chip a fiction. And he says that it is this fiction that Israelis and Americans both have believed over the past several decades that have really sustained relationships between the two countries because it means that there's a possibility of peace. However, it's almost the Peter Beinart path where they come to the conclusion that Israel has de facto annexed this territory and anything otherwise is, you know, propaganda or it's wishful thinking, maybe. What are your thoughts on that?
So first, in kind of what's happening within Israel now, it's interesting. I mean, I'm sure you've noticed that the people in government often emphasize the disengagement as this crucial moment. Like you really have a sense that they're operating almost as a very toxic combination of resentment and revenge where they're saying, where were you in the disengagement? As if, you know, this was like a terrible moment. And all those people who claimed to be Democrats were these authoritarians who supported this engagement. But disengagement, again, was a classic Zionist move of trying to secure a sovereign Jewish state and smaller borders and to disentangle Israel from places that would endanger sustaining Israel as a Jewish state. But I think what happened to a lot of the settler and the settler vision, which is clearly an illiberal, non-democratic vision for Israel, what happened to it in the disengagement is that they realized that at the critical moment, most Israelis don't care. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of Israelis, and today they want to forget it, disengagement was basically a consensus. It was broadly supported in Israeli society. Most people did not understand what we were doing in Gaza. We were happy to get out of it. And they realized that at the end of the day, most Israelis didn't care because most Israelis still subscribe to the Zionist ethos of preferring a state for the Jews over territory. What matters is really the state. And I think they embarked on a 20-year campaign to ensure that the state of Israel as a state would not be able to do that to them again. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I look at the current moment and it's almost a kind of a race. Who will destroy whom first? Israel, the settlements, or the settlements, Israel? Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of what's going on right now. But the whole notion that Israel, kind of the settlements, the fiction, the West Bank is not being held temporarily. You know, well, together with the D. Schwartz, I wrote a book, The War of Return, that basically says the problem was never, and I would argue still not, Israel and its wishes for the West Bank. The problem is, always been, still is, that the Palestinians have never, not for a single second, been willing to pursue a vision of peace, of partitioning the land between a Jewish state and an Arab state. As far as they're concerned, getting Israel entangled in the West Bank, ending the idea that one day there will be a Palestinian state in the West Bank is what they want. It's what they've always wanted. They've correctly understood that having a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza would secure the Zionist vision. Mm-hmm. They know that, mm-hmm. which they have zero interest in helping.
Exactly.
So the problem is not that. The problem is whether the Arabs, the Palestinians, will agree to finally have a state next to Israel rather than instead of Israel. If tomorrow Netanyahu says, look, I'm normalizing relations with Saudi. As part of this normalization, we have to agree to a Palestinian state. We'll make security arrangements and all that. And his baritone voice, he will say, trust me, you know, Israel will be secure. The vast majority of Israelis, including on the right, will say, hi, the Bibi. Like, yeah. So the problem on that specific issue is not what Israel is trying or not to do. The problem is, has remained, the Arab willingness for partition. And if that happens, they will always find willing Israeli partners. And I'll explain just quickly why. Because, as I said, Jewish unity is not a thing. But one thing that is a thing is that the Jews are a small people. We're a tiny people. We're very much aware of that. If we can secure ourselves in this region with 500 million Arabs, with 1.3 billion Muslims, and know that we can live here in peace and have our sovereign state, and the price of that will be the West Bank, vast majority of Israelis and Israeli Jews will say absolutely yes.
Thank you so much, Einat, for those insights. Definitely keep them in mind as the political turmoil continues to unravel in Israel. It's an essay of optimism, I think, and reassurance. So.
I hope so.